Hi, yes, I'm standing in for Paul Allen. My name is Bruce Hegarty. Unfortunately, Paul
Hegarty.
Bruce Hegarty. Basically, I've come to tell you about our new book, which Alan over here has just managed to produce, and called Zero Carbon Britain. It's the second report from the Zero Carbon Britain team at the Centre for Alternative Technology. So what I thought I'd do this morning is take you through some of the chapters, obviously not all of it, because it's 350 pages long, and then we could actually have a little go at working out what we think Zero Carbon Britain will be like in certain sectors that we've looked at, and then we'll show you the solutions that we've come up with. So, why the Centre for Alternative Technology? I'm not sure how many of you have been there or know about the Centre for Alternative Technology. Okay, it's been going for 37 years. About 37 years ago, a group of idealists, basically, many people say they're idealist hippies, but they were fairly practical hippies, went to Wales and found themselves a slate mine and a quarry and started practicing sustainable architecture and renewable energy techniques, and that's why after 30, and they've been doing that for about 37 years. In 1977, they came up with something called the first alternative energy strategy, which they took to Parliament, handed it in. I'm not sure how much notice was paid of it, and then 3 years ago, in 2007, they revisited that idea, and they thought, right, okay, that was a good idea, why haven't we been doing this? And 30 years later, they revisit it, and they say, okay, let's have a look. And what they came up with, and which surprised them, was that actually you could get down to zero by using alternative energy sources and reducing the amount of energy that we use. So they had two main ideas here. One was power down, reducing the amount of energy we use. The transition has a lot to do with that. And then powering up with renewable energy technology. And they want to look not just at the environmental things, but also climate security, energy security, economic security, and international security. Because obviously, you know, all of these things are interlinked, it's all very well Britain decarbonising, but if we can't get involved with policies that involve the rest of the world decarbonising, what are we doing? So, basically started here. Society is now aware of many pressing challenges. Lots of people are clearly doing lots of great work and transition amongst them. What's our target? You know, what's a safe target for us to aim for in terms of carbon? How much time have we got to get there? You know, how speedy does the transition have to be? And how does everything fit together? And this is where Zero Carbon Britain came into its own, because we looked at, basically we started with the temperature that was considered safe, which was 2 degrees, although some people dispute that and think it should be lower than that, maybe 1.5 degrees above 1990 levels. By having done the Zero Carbon Britain, the 2007 report, we'd already galvanised a lot of interest amongst some of the most, you know, the expert thinkers in and NGOs and think tanks, and so we were able to get them on board to help us write the report. And we wanted it to be evidence based. We wanted to be able to show that this was possible. So the NGOs we work with are these: NEF, Soil Association, National Energy Foundation. We work with these universities as well. Industry, although obviously renewable industry, River Simple has the car project, Bioregional M-Power, you've probably heard of, dancing with the devil a bit, I know, but they certainly have a lot of interest in energy. In fact, we have a contact in M-Power who works on tidal power, so that's why we're working with them. The Waits project are a building firm who do very highly insulated buildings. And different research centres who are interested in environmental things. Can you hear me properly? So I was kind of expecting a microphone. I'll try and project more, but I'm not very good at speaking now. And so this is our 18-month process. Basically, CAT staff got together, organised a series of seminars.
Do you want the microphone? You're okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll up it a bit. thanks. The CAT staff got together, organised a series of seminars, invited experts in the different fields that we were going to look at, you know, land use, buildings, policy and economics, and then after those seminars, one person was chosen to write each chapter, and eventually that chapter was then sent out to all the other experts for corrections and ideas, brought back in, and it's been a very long 18-month project, and you can imagine how difficult that is, getting lots of experts on boards who have slightly different ideas. And I can imagine there's a fair amount of, you know, disagreement here about how exactly is the right way to do things. Well, with people who've been researching all their lives, there's a lot of disagreement. But we think we've come up with the best solutions that we could glean from all of these experts. And this is, I mean, we're proud that basically this is the first fully integrated solution to climate change for Britain, because it looks at international policy as well as national policy, but it also looks at electricity, heat, transport and land use. And land use is one of those things that's been largely ignored in zero carbon scenarios up until now. So starting at the beginning, one or two of these things I'm sure you've seen before, but in 1986 there was a Swedish physicist, Svante Arrhenius, who concluded that adding to the greenhouse gas layer through burning fossil fuels would raise the Earth's temperature. It's kind of like wrapping the world in cellophane and not stopping and carry on wrapping it, and the heat and the sunlight can get through, but we're trapping the heat around the Earth. And there was a man, I can't remember his name, but he used to go up in Mauna Loa in the Pacific, and he used to go up every day and measure the carbon dioxide levels. And he, and thanks to him, we're able to show that the carbon dioxide levels have indeed been going up ever since industrialisation began. And we've gone up to 380 parts per million. That's per million molecules in the air. And the results of that have been that our temperature has gone up. Not surprisingly, you put lots of cellophane around the Earth, then it's going to heat up. And whereas before industrialisation began, we were at an average temperature of minus 0.4 degrees centigrade. And you've got to remember, this is an average temperature for the whole Earth. This isn't our average temperature. And we've now gone up to 0.4. Incidentally, 2010 has proven to be another year where we've hit record world temperature levels over the last 12 months. And what are the effects of this? Well, it's important to remember again, we've had a cold winter, and everyone's saying, oh, it's been cold. What's all this about? What's all this global warming? But again, it's average temperatures. And actually, it's the temperatures in the poles that are increasing more than the temperatures elsewhere, which is the dangerous thing, because then you've got places like Greenland, who've got huge amounts of ice, and that's gradually melting. China, you've got these dust storms, and basically what you've got is not temperatures going up everywhere. You've got far more energy on the Earth in the ocean, causing much more energy in the air. And the energy in the air is causing extreme weather events. So you've got these dust storms in China. This is tornadoes in the States. And this is Tewkesbury down the road. I don't know how many of you have been affected by flooding. I used to live in Oxford, and we've had two or three floods over the last 5 years. Lots of people flooded out of their houses. And these events are just becoming more frequent. So what... one of the most extensive works on what the safe temperature to aim for has been done by a man called Malten Meinshausen. And his answer to basically what we need to do is, he says, for an 84% probability of avoiding 2 degrees centigrade, a little bit statistical, of global warming, global emissions must be cut by 72% from 19 levels by 2050, and emissions must then near zero by 2100 globally. But there are people who disagree that 2 degrees is the right thing to be aiming for, and so we should be, particularly the small island states who've got very low-lying land and are worried about flooding and sea level rises, they want us to aim for something less. And so they split off in Copenhagen to form different groups. But basically, an 84% probability of avoiding 2 degrees centigrade, and that's where all the tipping points are. Personally, I wouldn't cross the road with an 84% probability of arriving safely at the other side. So who's producing the carbon dioxide? Well, you can see up here the darkest countries are the ones producing the most. Now you've got China over here, who've just overtaken America. Ourselves, pretty up there. And you can see that in Africa, one of the more innocent countries where they like to suffer mostly from the effects of climate change, they're producing the least carbon. And this tells a slightly different story, this one. Look at this, Australia and America again, but look at China. It's much paler colour there. And the reason for that being that actually, you know, it's their population. That's why they're producing more carbon than the States, I'm sure you know. And if you look at it per person, Australia is one of the highest. There's the States. UK, okay, we're still 12 tonnes of CO2 per person. But actually, if we're going to aim for 2 degrees, we've all got to try and bring our carbon down to about 2 tonnes a person. And so we've got some very serious choices to make. And how are we emitting our carbon? That last image and this little thing on the left are from a book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air by David Mackay, which I thoroughly recommend. And he basically sets out how much energy we're using in different areas of society and has a look at it. So you've got the domestic sector, non-domestic buildings, transport, industrial commercial processes, land use, imports and energy production. I'm sure you've seen this before. This is the other aspect of the report, energy security. This is the Hubbert's Peak. This is the production of oil. And we are obviously nearing the end of oil, and they reckon that between now and 2031 is the time when we reach peak oil. So this is why we've got to start getting prepared now. Currently, 60 out of 98 countries are running out of oil. And this is us. This is our energy security. In 2004, we became a net importer of gas and oil. This is, and basically, if we're starting to import more and more in order to be able to produce everything that we do, that also affects our economic security as well. So, what are we going to do about it? These are typical responses that you see from people in the street. You know, plenty of you have had conversations with people in the pub or having a cup of tea, and really. Largely people don't want to know, and those who do want to know, it's not really their problem. And I quite like this little cartoon on the edge, burying my head in the sand of the climate change. It's much easier. So, now I thought what would be interesting to do is for you to split us into groups and just have 15 minutes where you have a look at different aspects of society. I'm going to give you some more information before we do that, but I thought we should choose the groups first and do a little workshop on looking at four different aspects of society. So we're going to look at buildings, land, transport, and sort of put heat and electricity together, because largely that's, at least a decent amount of that's domestic. So I don't know if people have preferences, but I thought for brevity's sake, I'd probably just take a section. How many people have you got? 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24... 27, divided by 4, so about 6 people in each group. So let's just take you 6 to talk about land use. You 6 to talk about buildings. Okay. Transport over here. 7 is fine. And the last one. It's power production, electricity, and heat. So, you guys over here. Can you choose a scribe? Is that someone with a pen and paper? And I'll get together. Have a little talk about this and then. Okay, has everyone got a scribe? Yeah, each group got a scribe?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so for the built environment? You guys. Okay, so. Quickly, write down some percentages. This is the energy use and UK emissions, but the energy use is important thing for the domestic sector and the space heating sector. Now, remember, what we're trying to do is bring carbon production down to zero, nothing. We want absolutely nothing by 2030. So we've got 20 years to do it.
Let's force
source. Ah, okay, yes. Sorry, this is a sneak peek of my new book before it comes out and we take it to Parliament on Wednesday. This book, Zero Carbon Brick.
Is it for sale? So you're talking
Have we got any for sale?
No.
But what I've got is I've got a sheet that if anybody does actually want a copy, you can write your names down, put your emails down, and we will email you with details of that.
Thank
you.
A
press preview?
Yeah. On Thursday, not before the launch.
Yeah, not before the launch. There's a press conference on Wednesday.
Are you going to put it through online then, like the last one?
Yes, yeah. I mean, obviously we'd prefer you to buy it, but it is £40, and we understand that not everybody can afford that, so it will be put free online like the last week. Okay, you ready? Next, transport. So this is where the emissions are coming from in transport. 40% from cars. Who's the transport group? Okay, 40% from cars, railways. With aviation, well, okay, no, see what you think about aviation as well. Okay, land use. Now, this is still interesting for other groups because we're all going to look at all of this in the end. Now, this is a little bit of a complicated one. When I first saw it, I couldn't really work it out. But you're looking at three things here. You're looking at what land area this particular bit of land use takes up, the amount of carbon emissions it produces, and then the output, which is the amount of tons of calorific value that that particular area of farming produces.
Have you looked at it from the aspect of locking carbon out into the soil?
That's sequestration, and yes, there's that as well, but that's not part of this.
This can have a significant effect.
Well, absolutely. Who's land use?
We are.
We're the Eden Parrot.
You can come and talk to land use.
Yeah, well,
if you need any advice. I think this is going to look, so this is pretty obvious of what we're going to try and do, and don't be sympathetic, you know, what needs to be slashed needs to be slashed. We need to stop producing carbon, otherwise we'll go over 2 degrees, so look at this seriously.
So it's just include all the artificial insecticides, herbicides, fertilizers, nitrates. We want other figures included for industrial inputs which are required for the
I haven't, no, but I can tell you that fertilisers and nitrogen is about just over 50%, methane is about 20 and carbon is about 30.
So no DEFRA conveniently dumped those figures into DEFRAs?
Dumped? Which figure?
DEFRA very conveniently haven't included the inputs to agriculture into the agricultural emissions.
Okay, I
think
which
is a very skewed view of emissions crop.
We have. We've taken it into account.
And there's a big difference. For example, there's a book that came out. If you have wetlands or pastures, for beef or whatever, you have carbon sequestration, so that figure would be totally different there.
Okay. Maybe. A lot of this comes from you have to. I mean, largely, if you're using good grassland for cattle, then your land use is still, you're still producing a lot from methane and possibly using less nitrogen fertilisers. You're right, but largely, if you're trying to produce large cattle herds, then you're using nitrates and you're adding nitrates to the soil, and therefore your emissions are. But you're right. These are average figures for the overall dairy industry. This isn't. You can move towards organic things. And largely the land use chapter is looking at the whole of the land use in the UK and trying to say, okay, if we change all of this, what would we do with it? We're being idealistic, and we're not apologising for that. You know, it's sure there are other solutions, and also, you know, on we don't get rid of all of cattle. We don't. Our solution is not to get rid of cattle altogether, but to look at it seriously. Okay. I don't want to get too much of a discussion now because we're going to have more of one later. Thanks.
Is that put there, the usable product? Is that your definition of output?
Output is tons of calorific value. Tons of calorific value. So you wouldn't say a ton of meat is the same as a ton of rice because you're going to get more calorific value out of the meat if it's a ton of it. Okay? Yep, you guys all right? That's the last one. Oh, and I see that. Who's the gentleman over there? Yeah, this, I also wanted you to look at sequestration as well, as an idea. You understand what sequestration is? Locking carbon in to either the soil or into trees themselves, or using wood in construction or for artifacts that, because obviously wood, trees grow from taking carbon dioxide out of the air and turning them into wood. You know, this was originally carbon dioxide in the air. Now, if you're using that wood to build something, this is now, until this building burns down, heaven forbid, or, you know, this gradually degrades or is replaced and put on the dump, this is carbon locked in here. So think of sequestration as something that happens in the soil, something that happens in water, something that can happen in farming but doesn't seem to, and with artifacts that are built out of wood. Okay, energy producers. This is our energy production. We've got about 25% coal, 25% natural gas, about 60% oil, or more than that, and then very small number of renewables over here. Now, obviously, in order to get down to zero carbon, it's fossil fuels, and using different forms of renewable energy. So I want to think about the ones you know of and which ones you think we would be able to do to produce all of our heat and power with. On our electricity flow chart, this is basically the idea of these. This is called a Sankey diagram, and basically the energy comes in over here, and this is where it's spent over here. I don't know if it will horrify you to know, but you can see that the conversion, transmission, distribution losses here are just absolutely horrendous with the way we're producing electricity at the moment. A coal-fired power station is about 30% efficient. About 65% of the energy goes up out of the chimney, and then the rest is losses in distribution losses. So we think there are better systems than this. Okay, so how long do you think it's about 15 minutes of rapid fire ideas coming out, and if you could write those down, and then we'll feed back, and then we'll have a look at the solutions that we came in up with out of. We've got a slight advantage. We spent 18 months over it and 37 years before that. So in 15 minutes, if you can come up with the right solutions, we're going to be pretty impressed. But it's worth a go. It's good to exercise this. Okay, so how do you make your area zero carbon? Obviously, it's the main question, but how would the new proportions be of the different aspects of your area? So you think about proportions as you go. Okay? Make your best guess at that. Sorry, that was all. Okay. Can I bring it back to the background? Great. Well, I'm really glad to see that you probably sounded like you could have carried on for another 15 minutes, and I'm kind of sorry to stop you, but I think the interesting thing is to see what you've come up with. Incidentally, incidentally, the Zero Carbon Britain team are working on a thing called the Matrix, which is a kind of a program that you'll be able to play with, and you'll be able to have a look at your own solutions, put them in, and get the answers back about how much carbon that you're producing from each sector, that kind of thing. So at some point we'll also do that. But it's in the process of being created. What I've got here for afterwards is, if you'd like to sign up for either a newsletter from CAT or a newsletter from the Zero Carbon Britain team or any of those things, you can put your name and email here and tick the boxes that you're interested in.
If you're already a member of CAT, I presume you'll get it anyway.
Yes. Well, not necessarily the Zero Carbon Britain newsletter. You might want to just go and, well, sign up here. But I'm glad to hear you're a member of CAT. Great. So, first one. Buildings. Who's the buildings? Who are the buildings people? Okay. Just before you go, this is our new... CAT's just had is having a number of little triumphs at the moment, but this is our new Wales Institute of Sustainable Education, acronym WISE. This is a round-earth wall, 7.2 metres high lecture theatre. It houses about... it's got about 20 bedrooms and things, and it opened last week. That was the local opening, and we had a big splash for things, and it was absolutely. If you get a chance to come and have a look at it, it's really worth it.
But you sort out the money for those programs?
Yes. We I work in the fundraising and development department, and the support was amazing. We basically had a 6-week appeal. We had a We had actually had £1 million shortfall, but we in order to get be safe, we needed to get £500,000, and we found 800,000 in about 6 weeks.
Wow.
It was pretty amazing. Anyway, buildings people, what did you come up with? Great, it is, absolutely.
And saying that it's just got to be mandatory, every building's got to be insulated, and you've got to have, you know, you've got to have people going around every single house and making it mandatory for every house to be insulated and for every heating system to be either renewable or super efficient, or, you know, talking, I'm talking about kind of community power stations and that sort of thing.
Hey, power stations for someone else.
Yeah.
Right, but yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that you'll have come up with as you're going through this, that all of these areas are very interlinked, and so you can't improve one area without talking to the people over there about the other.
Well, what we mean by that is that rather than everything, necessarily every single individual house having its own little individual solar generator,
right.
The collective ones for the community.
District heating. District heating systems, yes. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Really just saying all new buildings from now have to be zero carbon. You know, we've got technology, we can do it.
I mean, amazingly, that is actually government legislation at the moment. It's just that they're not actually sending the inspectors around to make sure that it happens. But they are saying that, you know, by 2016, all houses have to be zero carbon. But, and so, in fact, we're not going to be telling government very much new when we tell them that, which is very much what we're saying in our report. But what they do need to do is send the inspectors around and actually make sure it's happening, and find builders who aren't actually doing it. It can't.
Yeah.
But if you've...
So it's ludicrous saying build a zero carbon house if you're powering it.
No, but well, you can power it with renewable energy. That's what you guys were talking about.
So all your houses are off grid?
No. If your house is connected to a wind farm and all your power comes from a wind farm, then it's zero carbon. That's up to you guys what it's connected to. I'm going to find out from you. Okay.
The way they do the policy is that you can essentially offset if you build a new house.
Oh, so my indulgence is
There's the details about how they propose it, but they're not saying.
Wait.
Yeah.
You're not buying indulgences and you're not necessarily offsetting. If your power is being renewably produced, which is what this group is being talked about, then it is zero carbon, because if you've got 100%, you know, a really strongly insulated house, and your only electricity is coming from a wind farm, then you're zero carbon. No, we're talking about an ideal world, and that's what we want them to be built like.
No, I think it's reasonable to say that it's zero carbon if you are producing more energy.
Mm-hmm.
You may be connected to the grid, but if you're exporting more energy than you're using from the grid, that you can count that as zero carbon.
I think that would be wonderful. It's also very difficult to do.
Well, if you're exporting. Village Hall, that hopefully by the end of the year we'll be doing that.
Great, fantastic. But that's a village hall, not a house.
No, but I mean, it's nevertheless a community building.
Right.
Which,
fantastic.
Hopefully, it's an example to other people that can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Okay.
The biggest thing was the social behavioural change required,
mm-hmm.
And kind of the
social aspects of that behaviour change, talking about cooking and kind of cooking together, only using what you need, co-housing, we talked about co-housing, sharing space.
Yes,
yeah.
Good jumper. Yeah. What, more jumpers?
Yeah, in the winter.
Yeah, more quiet. Okay. Well, so I'll show you a few of the things that we've talked about. Obviously, I can't cover a whole 350-page book, but behavioural change has its own chapter, and we've looked at, you know, how you bring about behavioural change as well. But I'll show you a few of the ideas we've come up with. This is the Stadhouse. It's built in London. This it's completed this year. This is a wooden building, one of the largest, the tallest that's ever been built, and apparently within a very, very short amount of time. The first four floors are offices, I think council offices, and then the rest of the apartments were bought within an hour and a half of it being opened, because people wanted to be part of this, you know, low carbon world.
What's it called, sorry?
Stadhouse.
Stadhouse.
Yes. Do you know why it's called German name?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the Towering Inferno.
No, I mean, you can treat wood. You can treat wood so that it's inflammable, and that's what they've done, and that's what we've done in the Wise building as well. So I know it's kind of scary, and you think of the three little pigs and that kind of stuff. Obviously, double glazing, triple glazing, this is really going to help if your house is really insulated and you've got normal windows. So, I mean, and one of the main things that's got to change, we found, was these listed buildings and the fact you can't double glaze them and triple glaze them. That's absolutely crazy, and they're the biggest emitters.
I think the Heritage have done some very interesting work on that. So,
okay.
Great. Yeah, I just done a study on.
I'd like to, get that off you later if I could.
So, you say double glazing or triple glazing. Are you?
Am I saying if you can afford triple glazing, get triple glazing? But you also have to work out how much money you're spending, on that, as opposed to on other measures of mitigating your carbon output. So you have to work that out. Everybody has to work it out for themselves. These are all buildings at CAT. I've already talked about the Wise Lecture Theatre. This is also the Wise complex, which is basically where these are the bedrooms, and the whole building is built with lime. Hemp lime render, which has very, very good insulation and things, and it also allows the walls to breathe, as they say, allows moisture in and moisture out.
You get a hive from breathing in the hemp.
I was going to say sadly not, but I'm not sure. Thank God not. I mean, it would be quite difficult for you going down the lectures in the morning and going back up. What was I doing for my homework? Oh, look, a tree.
You achieve all your aims.
Focus. Wood we already talked about, and that's locking in loads of carbon. But also passive, you can see this is passive solar. If you can bring that heat in through, glazed windows and allow that to heat up your house. And use the light as well. I mean, one of the great things about the Wise buildings, the amount of light that is natural.
How do you counteract overheating? Because refrigeration is a big user of energy, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're bringing all that heat into the building in the summer, how do you counteract overheating?
Well, we use a really tricky technique. Open a window? There's mechanical heat ventilation recapture where you can actually or you can do it the other way around. You can get colder air from outside and inside. You can also chill houses with ground source heat pumps. You can actually reverse the cycle and you can get cooler. Electrical energy. So you've got to have all your energy being produced by renewable.
But design is so important to cool buildings.
Yeah, as much as possible. Absolutely. The rest of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to sort of slow down on the questions now because otherwise I won't finish the lecture.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No, that was it. Could we just read?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, built environment, focus on fabric and ROI, and this is the system of energy return on energy invested. Materials, or you can use it for a wind turbine, you know. A wind turbine has a... We decided we should be building 180,000 new sustainably built houses a year, and we should retrofit our 20 million homes in 20 years. That's a million houses a year, starting now. This is what would need to happen to bring buildings down to zero.
So, is that building new houses and getting rid of the old ones then?
The ones that you get rid of, the old ones that you really can't insulate, you really, that are bad carbon emitters that you really can't do anything about.
But what about the embodied energy in those?
Well, you have to make that. You have to make that calculation. Download the chapter. It's there. Oh, hang on. Can I finish? And natural material selection. We've kind of covered already. Hemp, lime, wood. Transport. What do the transport people come up with? Let's do quick bullet points, because as Lady pointed out, we've only got half an hour.
Yeah, well, basically we need to relocalise and reduce route to travel as much as possible. We can make much more use of active travel, walking and cycling and public transport for every country and everything else, and then electric cars and electric railways, and look at using canals and coastal shipping to replace goods transport as
right. Well,
and a little bit of aviation might still be possible.
Great. Pretty much what we said. Really, really, pretty much what we said. That's amazing. Electrification of cars and rail. Town planning. You know, you've got to actually. You need to plan towns so that people can't drive in with cars. And my partner works in town planning, and she's basically putting high. She's making it expensive for people to park inside houses and make yourself very unpopular. But and making people have to get the bus in, putting parking rides in, things like that. We cut flying by 2/3, much more efficient public transport, much more of it. And also reducing the weight of vehicles. There are other plastics and things that you can use for vehicles that will make it less, you'd be using less energy to move them around. They can still be extremely strong or stronger than metal. The modal shift, which is what you were talking about, getting people to walk and cycle more. And we use different fuels. Did you come up with different fuels for your transport?
Well, yeah, we don't know how. We were saying, maybe that's an option, but we don't really know how realistic it is.
Well, we were talking about biofuels. Everyone's going, biofuels. But these are second generation biofuels that can be produced from a process called the Fischer-Tropsch process, which is lignocellulosic biofuels, which basically you can take woody bits and then use this process to produce fuels for your car. And you can use marginal land. This is not, our idea is not to be using land that you would otherwise be using for food. This is using marginal land that you couldn't use for that. And actually we came up with, I think it's 1.67 million hectares devoted to this. And those fuels can power your planes and the large vehicles that you can't power electrically. Everything that can be powered electrically should be. But those things that can't be, like your HGV vehicles, you're going to need other ways of doing it.
Isn't the cost of producing hydrogen almost prohibitive?
It can be produced electrically through hydrolysis. And so what we've got is when you've sorted out your renewable energy from offshore wind farms, and I hope you've got some of those in there. At night, when that power's not being used for other things, you can use it for producing. You can use that electricity for producing hydrogen. Then, when other things aren't using it, that's when you would also be powering your electric cars. When we're not using the electricity for other things, and so that actually helps manage the variability of wind power and things. Yeah, but we're trying to get rid of all fossil fuels, so yes and no.
But in Bethune, all the cars, and not that they can buy cars, but they all produce cars, they come out as bio cars, so they can run alcohol and petrol.
Right.
So I don't know if that's the solution to do cars that are flexible.
Well, we want to get as few cars as possible, but those cars that we do have, we want to replace the the rest of the cars that we've got with electric cars. That's the idea. I'm really going to stop now because I'm going to run out of time. I'm not going to finish.
Yeah.
So I'm really sorry. But okay. And so that's the proportion of transport that we got to. And so you know, there's still quite a large proportion of cars, but they're all electric. More rail, more coach.
More rail.
Yeah. And aviation is internal aviation. And that tiny bit down there, it's kind of between yellow and green, that's aviation. The rail is the purple one. I got confused about that. I thought, oh, loads of internal flying.
Is it a myth that, or true, that there's a huge difference if it's a jet or propeller flying? So internal
flying
is the propeller that's going to be today.
Pass.
I think it makes a huge difference.
Okay. Yeah, okay. But I can't answer that question. I'm sorry. So these are the proportions of fuels. We've got hydrogen, biofuels, so for aviation, mainly biofuels. Motorbikes worries me, the idea of a hydrogen motorbike, but I mean, that's what the experts are feeling. But anyway, have a read through. Land use. Okay, again, quick bullet points if we can. Who's doing it?
Sure. We talked about small mixed farms, principles like growing organic, permaculture, what have you, making use of human waste, composting it, more people living in rural areas, working land, eating a lot less meat, more vegetables, what have you. Anything else?
And using more of that hedgerow and so that you get layers growing.
Forest garden.
Yeah,
it's
tight
space,
but
particularly around it. And obviously changing our culture.
Changing?
Our kind of food culture.
Moving away from leisure to actually sustenance.
Right. Did you think about sequestration at all?
A bit.
Not to worry, that's right. Anyway, great. And lots of things that we've come up with as well. So this is the current one that we showed. If you look at the milk and beef, basically, I'll show you that this, our final version of that. But yeah, low impact farming methods, organic farming, crop rotations, anaerobic digesters on farms so that you're not using the nitrogen fertilisers. And anaerobic digesters have a double win because they take all your waste and manure in it. You get syngas out that you can use for cooking and heating and things. And it also leaves you with the fertiliser that you can carry onto your field. So for farming, absolutely fantastic. Dietary changes, yes, a lot less meat. We've got rid of 80% of cattle and dairy, but retained 80% of pigs because food waste can be fed to them, and hopefully the laws will change and will also allow that to happen. And we're going for largely national self-sufficiency in food, about sort of 20% imports left, about, where have we got to? 15% from the EU and 7.5% from the tropics imports. And what else have we not been through there? Sequestration of carbon, yes. There's quite, at the end of the report, we found that we hadn't got completely to zero carbon, but if we used a serious amount of sequestration techniques, then we could get down to zero carbon. And one of those sequestration techniques is biochar, which is turning wood that can't be used for anything else into charcoal and then burying it in the ground. And apparently it's very, very good for the soil as well. But this is new. So that was our end-up scale of land use. This is the 2030 version. You can see you've got in-situ biomass, biochar, silos, which is like having dumps where you put vegetation that you can't use for anything else and just leaving it there. So it's a little bit out there, that bit. But yeah, you can see far fewer poultry, eggs, milk, pigs, beef, and much more pulses and beans in your diet. And actually, it coincides extremely well with the Harvard School of Public Health's idea of what is the perfect diet for, and most healthy diet for people to live. And this was purely based on longevity and statistics that they've done. So you can see that the top bit, which is red meat and butter, rice, bread, pasta, tomatoes, soda and sweets, they say use that sparingly in a healthy diet. And so it's not such a bad idea to be changing our diet around if we want to live longer. Whether living longer is a good thing for the carbon output of the planet,
this is being revised, and the latest thinking is actually vegetables and fruit become to lower, and the whole grains.
You're right. This is 2005, and I know it's been revised since, but we've kept this one because this fits better with zero carbon grains.
Just means even more emphasis on horticulture.
Okay, guys, heat. Thanks. Heat production. How are you going to produce our heat?
The first thing was reducing carbon use, and we talked about individual carbon quotas. Reducing waste in production, and we talked about sources of energy, particularly in the UK, renewable energy, wind, wave, hydro, geothermal, solar, combined heat, proof of carbon, and micro hydro.
Okay, that's all for electricity. Did you do anything for heat, or...?
Well, biomass boilers.
Great, there you go.
Small-scale decentralised energy production, I thought was vital. And energy concentration on renovating existing household stock rather than new build.
Mm-hmm.
Electric vehicles and control power.
So you're seeing how all this is connecting up with the other groups?
Storing power in batteries for others.
Mm-hmm.
District heating.
District heating systems, yeah.
Ground or air seep heat source.
Heat pumps.
Mm-hmm. Solar and PV.
We've talked about some fossil fuels. Coal to gas conversion and sequestration. Coal to gas, yes, that's the syngas. But again, we're trying to get rid of fossil fuels, so we'd much prefer to be using waste and animal feces for that, creating syngas than using coal gas.
And we talked about the more technology we use,
wave energy. Brilliant. Okay.
About nuclear or non-nuclear, it was pointed out.
Yes. Quite early on in Zero Carbon Britain, we said we want to deal with that nuclear because we don't know what to do with the waste and it's. It's extortionately expensive. I mean, so is offshore wind power, and they're on a par. But then if you count the cost of the clear-up, you get. And I don't know if you've heard, Chris Hume has recently said that they found that they need another £4 billion for the nuclear clear-up that he's been left with. And he said that's turned DEC into the energy of... The Department of Energy and Climate Change hasn't... Because that's taken all of their budget, he's now saying it's... They're the Department of Nuclear Clear-Up and Little Bits and Bobs.
It was like that, before.
Okay, we're going to carry on. So, heat production. Well, we've got ground source heat pumps takes up a huge proportion of the way that we've chosen to heat our houses. This is a ground source heat pump here. Works with the reverse way of a fridge. You get a gas that boils at a much lower temperature than water, obviously, but at a very low temperature, maybe, you know, 1 degree or whatever, that creates a certain amount of energy, and this machine here pumps that energy into your house and warms it up. Electricity for heat. Obviously, you need electricity to power these things. Basically, what we've done is we've said, we're going to double the amount of electricity despite the fact that we're trying to save electricity in other areas, we end up with a doubling of electricity in production through renewables. Largely from offshore wind farms.
Just question, what broadly do you consider for air sourcing pumps? There's clearly a lot of buildings, particularly in urban areas, they don't have access to the ground. So is there, what sort of...
We've kept that to a minimum because at the moment they're very inefficient. Once you've got as much renewable air just as you like, you can use those, but they're only tend to be up to 2-to-1 efficient, whereas ground source heat pumps are 4-to-1 efficient. So in an urban setting, putting solar hot water panels and using other techniques is better, or even using electric fires. It just goes around in a circle. It's a closed system. It's a closed liquid system. And the heat is taken out of the ground and pumped into the house, basically. Or the energy. A big one? I'm not going to go... if you want to ask me later, I can go into that. So you can see the proportions there. Biomass. Quite a large amount of biomass heat. You know, pellet boilers and batch boilers. And that's basically our new energy mix. 3/4 of our energy produced by offshore wind farms, and there is good evidence to back this up. There's a report that's come from a group down the road that's called PERC, the Public Interest Research Centre. It's just done an offshore valuation of our wind resource and said that basically we've got enough electricity in the North Sea to produce about 6 times the amount of what we need at the moment. So we produce a third of that for producing our heat and our power, and we can sell the rest across to Europe. That's it. That's it. Have a look at the report. This isn't cats. So that's the projected change between now and 2030. That's where most of our offshore wind resources are. This is an intensity map, so that shows you where the intensity of our wind is. But you would want to have wind turbines down the southwest as well, because if you get a lull up there, then you've got to balance that with energy production from elsewhere. And then we were preparing to balance that with gas-fired power stations. So in the odd occasion when you get a lull all around the UK, which is only about 4 or 5 hours a year, so everybody worrying about that, you know, wind energy lulls and the variability and it won't work, it's actually only for about 4 or 5 hours a year that you have a lull all the way around the UK and you're not getting any electricity. And during that time, we can use gas that we've got from gasification to power power stations that will make up the shortfall.
If climate changes the wind patterns,
there's still going to be wind.
They might not be with you stack your huge infrastructure in 30 years.
But I mean, the wind patterns may change, but there's still going to be wind. And actually, there's more energy. There's going to be more energy with more heat, so hopefully there'll be more wind. Okay, so WK electricity, which I've already said, and balance variability with European grid, use of smart grids and smart appliances, so your washing machine only turns on at night when electricity is really cheap and they're producing too much of it, and microgrids and microgeneration. Microgeneration is like having solar panels on your house and wind turbines up on the hill. And having a little grid that uses it before it goes into the main national grid. And this is the new Sankey diagram, so you can sort of see the proportions of what we intend to use there. And residual emissions. So, as I said, there's a certain number of residual emissions that total up to, we think, 67 million tonnes of carbon. And this is what we would have to deal with sequestration. And I've got a list, I think, of how much sequestration is going to take place. There we are. This is the last bit of your land use, but how you sequester 67 million tonnes of carbon.
Sorry, what's positive and negative mean?
Negative means that negative is not negative, has a negative attitude. That means it's negative emissions. So positive emissions is when you're actually emitting. Negative is when you're actually sequestering. Yeah, I totally agree. I think the wrong word was used on that chart.
Is the positive after you've taken into consideration the negative? Is it cancelled out?
Yeah, if we go back here, you can see that some of the residual emissions are from land use and agriculture, such as 17 there. So that's actually taken into account. And obviously we need you know, strong government policies in order to push these things through. You need movements like Transition Towns to get ground up, grassroots up, and then you need to encourage government to legislate for it. Otherwise, you might choose to do the right thing, but your neighbour isn't going to.
Is there any attempt to cost within the book? And if so, is it on the present case scenario, or does it take into account?
There's an economics and policy chapter. It talks about where the money's going to come from, but actual exact costs are so hard to come by because, you know, prices change, the pound's going down.
Is there a peak oil in there? I'm saying, like, we need to just do this now while we've still got oil available, because
yes, absolutely. Yeah, we need to be using our oil now in order to produce all of this new transport and solution-focused strategy, based upon the idea of contraction and convergence. I'm sure you'll have heard this term before, but basically you set a cap on emissions, you set a temperature, you set a cap on emissions, and then we all sort of meet up in the amount we're allowed to emit. So hopefully the states are coming from here, we'd be coming from here, and those countries that need to have development and want to have a decent standard of living are allowed to up their CO2 emissions in order to sort of reach a decent standard of living, and then we all decrease it as we're using more renewable energy.
How
feasible,
like,
how?
Politically feasible, like, likely is that?
After Copenhagen, I couldn't tell you. but our policy chapter looks towards pushing for an international agreement. That's our number one choice. And if you can't do it, then there are various different policy options that we look at. In fact, three roadmaps to decarbonising. The first one's towards an internationally harmonised carbon price. That's basically making sure that, I don't know how many of you know the EU ETS, the trading scheme for carbon that's on at the moment. Carbon prices have been kept extremely low, about $20 a tonne, and it needs to be up to about $200 a tonne for us to be able to make the money in order to put in all the changes that need to take place. So it's how you bring about that. And possibly it's not by giving the emitters thousands of permits to just pollute for free, too many permits to pollute for free. So you've got, towards an internationally harmonised carbon price, so you've got one price on carbon, so... And it's the same around the world. That wouldn't make for a very fair solution for people in Africa who have less money than us. So we're looking at a number of different policy options. An international agreement on carbon budgets is what we hoped would come out of Copenhagen, but unfortunately hasn't. And in which individual nations would decide their own pricing, but that hasn't come about. I think we should still be pushing, zero carbon things, we should still be pushing for that, but if it doesn't happen, then we've got the third roadmap, in which there are no global agreements, and groups of countries band together and agree their own limits and their own prices for carbon. It's a bit less optimistic, because I'm sure, you know, Europe might get together and say, yes, we're going to really limit ourselves, but I can't see North America voluntarily doing the same thing if we haven't got an international agreement that doesn't shame them. But all of these policies are discussed in the policy and economics chapter. And what we're looking at is a real Green New Deal. If you can actually find the money in order to make all of this happen, then we're talking about thousands, hundreds of thousands of new jobs in all of the different sectors that we're talking about. A huge amount of reskilling would have to take place. We believe that it's possible to get a balance of payments by 2030. And obviously, once you've got your renewable energy producing all of your electricity, then you can have a stable price for your electricity, and that's going to be a lot fairer. And we'd like to set a global lead with it. Reasons to be optimistic: the offshore valuation report that I was talking about by Perk. I mean, if the resources really is there, we've sent people to the moon. Why? I'm sure we've got the technical ability to actually be able to access it. You know, and we've got plenty of experience of people in oil platforms out to sea. Ooh, probably a bad thing to say. But we're not talking about digging oil out of a long way down to the ground. We're talking about just putting a platform there and putting a wind turbine on top of it. And I'm sure, you know, these technologies are already there. We're already doing it. So all we need to do is roll it out, but a lot faster than we're doing so at the moment. And it needs investment. Another optimistic thing I didn't put there was I noticed in the I've got a copy here of the coalition, the new coalition report, and saying what they want to do. And I've completely forgotten what I was going to say.
What do they want to do?
Yeah, they're very, very positive. And Chris Hume took the first copy of Zero Carbon Britain to the Lib Dems, and basically they don't know if you know this, but the Lib Dems then formed their own Zero Carbon Britain, which had about 50% of the policies that came out of the first report in it. They didn't use the rest of them because they thought they were a bit too outlandish, but that's where we're starting from. We're starting from a very idealistic standpoint. And the last thing to be optimistic about is that on Wednesday we get to go and present this to Chris Hume and a number of politicians in Parliament. At the first meeting of the all-party parliamentary climate change group. So all of the new politicians that have got into power that are interested in the environment and finding out about solutions will have a copy put in their hands, and they can go away and think about it. But you guys got the sneak peek first. Yeah. I think this is actually the first big talk on Zero Carbon Britain 2030. So.
I see you've got tradable energy voters.
No, we haven't. Not entirely. It's one of the policy options. Tradable energy quotas is still in there as an idea, as one of the national policy options.
As for individuals, you mean?
Yeah. The tradable energy quotas is the idea that we're all given, business is given a certain amount of tradable energy. No, government divides up energy quotas around among the country, and there's different versions of it, aren't there? But basically, we would all get apportioned a number of energy quotas that we can then sell to people. Right, OK. You want to explain?
Well, no, I invented the scheme.
You gave a talk at CAT recently.
Yeah.
And I missed it. I was really annoyed. I'm sorry otherwise.
Well, trade energy quotas is basically that it's an all nation scheme. All energy users in one nation are part of the same scheme. An individual is getting entitlement, and all other energy users bid for theirs on the market, so there's one single market.
That's still it.
And the crucial point about it is that it is an effectively entitlement scheme. So when energy becomes scarce, which is certain to do, either under the context in the context of climate change solutions or in the context of oil depletion, every individual is guaranteed an entitlement. If one doesn't have a rationing system, then it means individuals won't be able to get energy. So any scheme which does not include a rationing system of some kind will mean that people will be condemned to fuel poverty. So it seems to me that whatever form it takes, there has to be that energy property in there. And Chris Hume is committed, as he told me several times, he's committed to using carbon taxation, which of course is completely irrelevant to the fundamental problem of guaranteeing an equal and fair entitlement to all energy users.
Yeah.
So it really does need to be in there.
It's still there. Can you check? Can I look?
I believe.
Go on. We finished now. So, we can have questions.
A couple of related points.
Okay.
Who's the target audience for this presentation? Who's the
policymakers?
Policymakers, okay. My second question is.
But everybody, because we all need to be encouraging policymakers.
A lot of people. What role, when we talk about this being a sort of top down solution, primarily because of the policymakers, what role do you see for community involvement and support?
A lot, because you've got your communities need to be encouraging politicians to make the right decisions, but also in your own area you've got to be working out what's the best way to produce your own energy. Is it better to be buying your energy off a wind farm, or is it better to put your own wind turbine up on a hill, or should you be having solar hot water panels on everybody's roofs, a district heating system, whatever? But I think Alan was about to tell you about another book that's about to come out that would answer that question better. So thank you very much for listening. You can probably tell this is like the first talk I've done on this, well obviously because it's the first talk, but it's the first time I've had an audience.
Alan Shepherd, I'm the publisher at the Centre for Alternative Technology, so it's basically my job to make sure that the book got out on time and presented in a very nice way, so which wasn't easy. But what we want to do now is take the information within that book and make it relevant to community groups across the country, not just transition groups, but other community groups and individuals as well. Now, we've decided in the end not to do all the stuff on food and transport and the built environment, because that's covered by other books. So we're going to concentrate on heat and power, and to a certain extent energy conservation, both heat and power conservation. And from now on until about November time, I and a few different colleagues are going to be working on the book, and we're going to be gathering case studies from across the country of community groups that have already done this, and also individuals as well, in both heat and power, and how that might be working for the different transition groups with forming your energy descent plans, and whether you've had positive or negative experiences. So I wanted to be able to come to you guys and have a conversation with you about how that's been going, if some of the groups have been going 2 or 3 years, to see how far you've got and what hurdles you faced and what positive things have come out of the processes that you've been engaged with. And then we're going to combine that with the other different community renewable energy projects that are going on, and then present all that information back to you, plus all the technical nuts and bolts stuff. I mean, not in total, but for each different area, we'll have a description of what the different issues you need to think about when you're installing these different renewable energy powers. So that's the purpose of the book. It will be very practical, but it will also have the political element and the sense of deciding at what level we need to take action, whether it's very domestic, whether it's the local, or whether it's national and international levels, and then trying to work out where you guys can best put your energy to make stuff happen. So it's trying to be effective, cost-effective and time-effective, so you're not spending lots of time doing stuff that will achieve not very much. So that's the point of the book, and if you want to talk to me afterwards, and we can swap emails, and I'm hoping that Rob Hopkins is going to be writing the foreword for it, and I'm hoping through him that I'll be able to have a dialogue with you through the different transition websites and things. I'm still a bit new to all this, so I need to find out how it all works, but yeah, that's it really. So I'm hoping that you'll engage with me and we can have a good conversation about it.
And if you're in, sign up there's the book here that we've called it the Transition Technology book here. Yep. You don't know what it's going to be called in the end, but if you want to put in an email there and tick that box, then we'll let you know when it's out, and you can choose to buy it or not, or download it free, whatever.
Yes,
because I'm sure that'll happen again.
I work with people like Liverpool Technology Development Company, Chamber of Commerce, with councils, so it's sort of more of the strategic local level. Does that more
Zero Carbon Britain is a national level policy document.
Right.
But I mean, in order to work out what best to do at a community level, it's good to look at the whole national aspect. But it's not advising particular communities, because every community will have different solutions.
Yeah.
And you honestly can't do that when you're looking at a national policy. I don't know if I should pass this around or whatever. Were there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.